I'm Rebecca Lavoy, and welcome to the Undisclosed Addendum. Today, we're talking about episode one of the new season of Undisclosed. It's about Jeff Titus, who was convicted of the 1990 murders of Doug Estes and Jim Bennett 12 years after their double homicide in 2002. Titus is currently incarcerated in Michigan and has always maintained his innocence. Now, if you haven't listened to the episode of Undisclosed, we're going to be talking about plot points from it and details about it. So pause this. Go back and listen, and then come back to this addendum. We will still be here, I promise. Our special guest for today's podcast, Jacinda Davis. She's executive producer at Red Marble Media, where she's deeply involved in many aspects of production on several series for Investigation Discovery, including the top-rated Evil Lives Here, Shattered, and the new long-format series Killer in Question. Jacinda started her career in true crime working on the long-running John Walsh series, America's Most Wanted. Jacinda, it's such a pleasure to talk with you.
Nice to talk to you as well.
Also with us is Kevin Fitzpatrick. He's president of Red Marble Media. The company has made over 150 hours of programming for networks such as History and Investigation Discovery. He's the executive producer of the series Evil Lives Here, as well as Shattered and the new long-format series Killer in Question. Kevin got his start working for ABC News. It's nice to meet you, Kevin. Thanks for coming on the podcast.
Thank you for having me.
And finally with us is Susan Simpson. She needs no introduction, but of course she is the DC-based lawyer and co-host of Undisclosed. Hey, Susan, it's great talking to you.
Hey, Rebecca.
So Kevin and Jacinda, we kind of have this like mashup this season. And by the way, congratulations on the excellent New York Times write-up of this season of Undisclosed paired with your TV treatment of this story. It's pretty exciting. But you have been working on shows for a while, and I'd love to hear more about some other of Red Marble shows. What sort of stuff have you been making? Jacinda, you want to tell me about that?
Sure. I've been with Red Marble for, what, Kevin, like 5 years, I think. And I've primarily been working on a series called Evil Lived Here, which is a show where we interview the loved ones of killers. So it could be a killer's wife or daughter or husband or whatever, to get their perspective on what it's like to find out that someone who you love and trust turns out to be a killer and how that affects their lives.
So I'm just curious, Kevin, what do you think of this idea that both the show that you are producing for Investigation Discovery and this podcast, this like juggernaut of a podcast that has been involved in so many wrongful convictions and, you know, played a key role in getting some people out? What do you think of these two things coming together when this first came across your radar that this is how this was going to go, Kevin? What did you think?
Well, I thought it was great because we were in a position where we couldn't do the Titus story in its totality. Right. Like we couldn't do the number of hours that Susan and Undisclosed can do and sort of give it that sort of fair shake and justice that I think that the story deserves. So we were very open to it from the beginning. And when Jacinda sort of, you know, brought the idea of Susan and Undisclosed to me, and Jacinda doesn't bring me ideas unless she really believes in them. And we both found this story to be amazing. That we hadn't heard of it before. And I thought that it lined up really well for us because, you know, Jacinda was just talking about Evil Lives Here. I mean, what we do basically for all of our shows, Evil Lives Here and Shattered, are POV interviews. We sit down with people and we discuss their perspective on what happened. And that's sort of the crux of how we make all of our shows, be they crime shows or science or whatever. And so we knew that Undisclosed did the same thing. That they're bringing people's perspectives and their POVs on what happened, and they're bringing that small element of what happened with them and how they saw it. They're creating a larger picture. So I thought that it would work great. And when she told me more about Susan and how they were sort of talking about it, I thought it was a great idea. I thought that the story would get more attention if we both did it.
I'm curious about the concept for Killer in Question. I mean, I've done a little bit of work as an interviewee on Investigation Discovery shows. I've written a few true crime books, and I know that That network in particular, and a lot of true crime networks, really like to have cases that are buttoned up, that have the right person incarcerated, where they can sort of tell the complete story. Potential wrongful convictions is kind of new in the like investigation discovery wheelhouse. How did you get them to do the show? How did they come to want to do this show? I'm just curious about that.
Well, it was their idea, and so you'll have to. And you'll have to ask them if they still want to make it, but no, I'm kidding. It was their idea. They wanted to do a show that sort of pushed the envelope. And I think that largely came from some of the previous shows we'd done for them, like Evil Lives Here and Shattered, where the conviction of the case really became a secondary factor. What the primary factor became was someone's POV. I mean, we don't have any narrators in our shows. And Evil Lives Here, you know, is about the family members of killers, but we don't talk about the crime very much. I mean, we talk about it at the very beginning and the very end. The rest are sort of their small perspectives of what goes on and how they figured things out. And Shattered is the same thing. And so Killer in Question was the next sort of incarnation in that. And I don't think we went into it saying that we're looking for stories where there's a wrongful conviction. I think we went into it looking for stories where people had differences of opinion. And that very naturally evolved into some of these cases where people are disputing whether there's a conviction. But the interesting thing that we wanted to do was find, as much as we could, people who were involved in the prosecution of the case or the defense of the case or investigating the case where they had differences of opinion, because that's really interesting. And you, it's easy to find family members who disagree with the findings of police officers or with the findings of a court decision. I think what we were trying to do was find cases where people disputed the evidence and they were the people who investigated the stories. And that very quickly leads you down the road to wrongful convictions. And I think the story came about, you're right, investigation discovery doesn't naturally do stories like that, although I think they're probably evolving more towards it. But I think it came down to they wanted us to push the envelope, which they often ask us to do with each show they ask us to make. And they trusted us to come up with a good story. And we never go into a show we're going to make with some kind of predetermined outcome. We go where the interviews take us and where the story takes us. And the Titus story took us into amazing places, which is how we ended up with Susan, because it became so big that we couldn't do it in a few hours. It needed more time. And ID trusts us to tell what we think is the best story. And that's sort of how we ended up with the Killer in Question that we have. I don't think anybody really knew what it would be when we started. But this is where we finished.
Wasn't it only going to be an hour long when you initially?
We were supposed to make, if memory serves correct, I think we were supposed to make 6 1-hours. And very quickly, as we started making them, I mean, I think I knew before we started making them that we couldn't make shows like this in 1 hour. The shows that we make are 1 hour, are usually one person's POV. And that's about what, you know, then that's generally fine. And you're still leaving things out that. But I knew that we couldn't get all these different perspectives in an hour. When the pandemic came, we hadn't filmed everything in the series. And ID agreed to let us do all of these as 2 hours. And I think that some of them still needed more time, right? Like, I mean, as we got into Titus, I mean, I think, you know, we'd been working on it for like probably all of 3 weeks, and Jacinda and I sort of said to each other, there's no way this could be an hour. Right. Like there's just so much material there. And every time Jacinda has this obsessive research sort of, I don't know what you call it, is it a tick?
We don't know anyone else like that on this podcast.
Yeah, right. Well, that's why the two of them together, it's a little unsettling. But you know, so Jacinda will Slack me or text me, like, you know, whenever she finds something interesting. And after a while, it almost became borderline annoying. Like, okay, right. I get that the story's interesting. Like,
Stopped texting you and I text Susan instead.
Perfect.
Yeah, well, that's
a match made
never annoying to me.
Yeah, it's actually great for me that's the whole reason I'm behind this partnership, because it means I have to talk to her less. But I also knew early on that if I didn't get more hours out of the Titus story for Jacinda, that was going to be a problem for me.
Right.
So I needed to to make that sort of happen. But yeah, they were all supposed to be hours. And
I can't even imagine how you'd cut Titus into like a 1 hour.
Listen, Susan, it happens all the time. I mean, I have written 400 word books that have turned into a half hour or hour long thing. And it's always a mess. Like everything important, it's gone. The only thing that's left in is like the stuff that's considered, quote, sexy. It ends up being not really real, not really representative of the story. So if you're going to like do it well, it does need more time. And I'm really impressed. It sounds like you're kind of bringing back like almost like a movie of the week kind of model with this series.
Yes.
It's very cool.
Yes, that's very much what it evolved into. And that's sort of how we were pitching it to them is these stories are so big that you can do them more than the standard hour. And thankfully there were some folks who really agreed with us over at ID and they pushed the idea forward. That is not a normal concept for programming there. I mean, they have very dedicated viewers and the viewers are used to getting 1 hour, you know, each week of a series and they return sort of religiously for many of those series. Thankfully, some of ours included. So this was a very different concept of one subject, over the course of 2 hours in one night. And yeah, it is kind of the movie of the week. And oddly, I believe CBS just brought that back for the pandemic as well. So
yeah,
I guess we're in good company.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think it's becoming more common too, even on like Dateline in 2020, to have these like 2 hour sort of mega specials when you have a case that takes you that far. Jacinda, I'm curious about this case and how it came onto your radar. I mean, I'm always kind of wowed when I hear, you know, I produce Undisclosed, so I hear sometimes the beginning of these stories. And the one thing that always, like, bowls me over is when you have an investigator who worked on the case that thinks the cops who ended up finishing it got it wrong. And that's what's going on here, which is, like, a super interesting aspect of this story. But I'm curious how it came onto your radar.
So when ID came to us with this idea of making this series, you know, I knew I would be traveling a lot. I knew I would be having to go to different cities. And I just started researching stories. And there's nothing noble about this, but I started researching stories in cities where I wanted to travel. I think the previous year I had been to like 23 or 25 cities shooting Evil Lives Here. And I was like, you know what? Now I'm going to focus on places I want to go. And I want to go to Michigan. I want to go to Detroit to check out Third Man Records. So I started researching murder in Michigan. It was really that simple. And Titus was one of the first stories that popped up when I started researching. And immediately I knew there's something special about it. Like you said, it's very, very unusual to find detectives who don't agree on the outcome of a case. And this many years later, they're still fighting about it. They still don't agree. The original detectives really believe Jeff Titus is innocent, and the cold case team absolutely believes they got the right guy. And to me, that was fascinating, and I could not wait to talk to both sets of detectives and figure out what was really going on.
I think about this a lot, Susan. With any conviction, right, whether it's, you know, the right guy or the wrong guy, I mean, I've interviewed enough cops to know that when they've made an arrest and they feel good about it, it's not just a question of like the professional, you know, kind of pride. There's also a thing where I think about a lot where they've told this story probably hundreds of times to friends, to family members, to colleagues about the time they caught that guy. Mm-hmm. And I wonder how much of that narrative of, you know, I got it right, just sticks because of that, because they've told themselves the stories so often. Why do you think it is that, you know, you could have two investigators who, you know, parallel professional tracks, probably have a lot of the same moral fiber, can, you know, one saying this is wrong and the other one saying this is right? Why do you think it sticks so hard in these cops' minds?
I think that this case in particular probably stands out a bit more than most because, for instance, the cold case team, as we'll get into later, has kind of made this their, like, signature case. They go out and teach this case is like how they broke the big cold case and got the right guy. And I think, and we'll explore this more as the series goes on, but I think also that the detectives from the original case are not the kind you'd normally expect to see taking this kind of role and sort of adamant opposition to the conviction that was obtained. But in this case, for whatever reason, their understanding of the facts is so firm and how they see it that, yeah, they feel compelled to come forward. I honestly, so I kind of think about season two of Joey Watkins' case. There was a detective in that case who was involved early on who there was signs did not actually really go on board the conviction or like kind of doubted it. Like he wouldn't go on the record either, but like he didn't seem behind the conviction. But he also would not go public in any way. He wouldn't say anything. He wouldn't make a stink. He just kind of kept rolling along. Right. Whereas here we have a detective who just like couldn't keep rolling along because of what they saw.
Well, I don't know what, Jacinta, you and Susan, what you guys think, but part of me also thinks that the reason it turned this way with the police against each other is simply because the cold case cops and the prosecution didn't call the original detectives at trial. The concept is just that I think that offended them. I think that gave them a push.
Yeah. I mean, for Ballot especially, I can see that mattering because they don't know why they weren't called. They're just as confused as we are today about why they didn't get called for the defense.
Well, they didn't get called because they were afraid, like everybody was afraid what they were going to say, right? In this.
Well, the defense shouldn't be afraid of that.
Well, but maybe they were. But anyway, I'm probably giving away too much of your show, but
it's okay.
My personal opinion.
It's not going to keep anyone from listening, I promise.
I also think, though, there's something larger going on, and not just in terms of the Titus case, but in cases in general, where, you know, when you arrest someone and you know you may be putting them in jail for life and taking them away from their families or whatever, I would imagine that weighs on you heavily. You need to know that you got it right in order to sleep at night. And so I wonder if there's if you almost have to dig your heels in and you convince yourself you're right, you convince everyone you know you're right because you're changing lives.
Because otherwise you did something horrible and that's hard to cope with.
Right. Right. I mean, I think that as we've learned over the years, there are some people in law enforcement and AG in prosecutors' offices who just may not think about that. They may not care. They may not think about it. Just a win is a win. But certainly, I think, you know, especially in these small communities, that can be the case. It becomes part of your story. And you think of yourself as a good guy. Right. Susan, I'm really curious about this love language I see between you and Jacinta. You seem to be quite the team. I'm curious about how you met and when you knew that this was going to work and you guys were going to be able to work together and do this collaboration.
I knew it was going to work when the pandemic hit and I was pretty low on options, being honest. At that point, we're like, well, I knew the case well at that point. I had no idea if this sort of informal, like, let's do the same case side by side together and see what happens. I'm not sure what I was worried about, but it worked out fine. But as for how we actually first met, Jacinta reached out to me last year. Yeah, 2019? Yeah. and the reason I actually went to meet with her is because I knew from people in the Joey Watkins case that they had received letters from this company, Red Marble. So she said, hey, I'm in town, want to meet up. And I went with the goal of basically telling her to back down from the Watkins case because I did not know what the company was. I didn't know what they were doing. Some of our cases, you know, they've been featured on true crime shows in ways that were pretty exploitive and pretty damaging to the cases. So I saw a true crime show was snooping around the Watkins case and I like assumed the worst. But then we met and I was like, oh, OK, so I got this all wrong. And from there.
Everybody, just to interject, everybody always assumes the worst when they first have contact with Jacinta, by the way. It's not an uncommon reaction.
Well, there's like a large spectrum of what true crime TV shows are. There's what you guys do, and then there's what other people do, which is like all the women characters are wearing negligees all the time.
Yes! What's with that?
Yeah, I think Jacinta and I both aged out of that.
I remember the first time we saw one of our books, my husband and I, he's my co-author on a show, which will go unnamed, which was actually kind of a big show. And all the women characters were wearing negligees and all the men were super handsome. And I was just like, what is going on here? What is going on? One of the things I'm curious about, and this is something that has come up before, but in this instance, you kind of pointed out enough in the first episode that I think it's a safe question to ask that you've probably thought about yourselves. Titus is, on the face of it, not a super relatable, or even to someone who's not into what he's into, super likable guy. Can you just talk about that a little bit? Talk about, you know, working on a case that is probably a wrongful conviction when you know you have a character at the center of it that, you know, just by nature of the things he says to people, might not, like, say, pull the heartstrings of a listener or viewer so much as, you know, other people that you've profiled on the podcast and I'm sure on shows that you've produced. Tell me what that's like, Jacinda. How is it sort of working around a character like Jeff Titus? He really is, you know, for lack of a word, he's a character in many ways.
He is a character, you know, and he says himself, people either like him or they don't. There's no in between. And I think that's true. I think we've talked to people who really do like him, you know, like Stan Driscoll, who you'll see in the show and was Jeff's hunting buddy for years and years and years. And they had a pretty close relationship, I think. And
he was his alibi too, right?
Yeah.
He was his alibi as well, you know? So I think there were people who really liked Jeff and appreciated Jeff. And then, you know, there's an equal amount of people who find him, odd and who prefer not to be in his company. He is an odd character. And is he likable? I don't know. I mean, Susan, what do you think?
He can be endearing in short bursts. No, that's not fair. Like, so, okay, in every case we do, they always demonize the defendant. Like, you have to. That's what the prosecutor does. In all these cases, you read through the case file and you're like, wow, this person must kind of suck a little bit. And then you get into it and you realize that this depiction is like nothing to do with reality. Like Joey Watkins again, like, hey, he sounds like the worst, like most awful kid on earth. Like some violent little scumbag. And then you actually like talk to people who know him and talk to him. And you're like, wait, this is just the story that they're committing to. They're using a few examples from his real life. I mean, like he's really awful when like he was never like on anyone's radar as like somehow like a standout for being this little monster, like the climate trial. And like in Dennis Perry's case, you've got someone who is completely inoffensive, like to the nth degree inoffensive, calm, quiet, has nothing in his background that's offensive. And even then they can turn into some guy who sounds like a druggie and violent. So with Titus, who I would probably concede gets a bit more room to work with on that front. Yeah, they can paint a picture of a total psychopath, really. But when you start getting into the case, it is more nuanced.
Well, I think the challenge with him, and I've not spoken to him as both Susan and Jacinda have, so I'll give my perspective from someone far away, which is, I think, what most people are doing in the case with him. He's completely unrelatable to virtually anyone. And so you can't, I think it's hard for people on the outside to imagine themselves in the position with him because he does not seem relatable in any way to virtually anyone. And he's only interested in talking about things that he finds interesting, right? As a scene that we filmed with him and his family on the phone. And, you know, he doesn't pick up on social cues. It becomes easy for people to imagine him in a certain manner. Be that accurate or not. But when you can't relate to people, I think it does become easier, whether they're guilty or whether they're innocent, it becomes easier to imagine them being guilty if you can't see a certain amount of humanity in him. And I think that it's hard to pick up on that from him from a distance anyway.
Right. I mean, this certainly isn't the first case that Undisclosed has covered where I've, you know, asked this a question like this. I think about like Tenjin Kensu. Like he, you know, he's this like lady killing karate dude that like, again, totally unrelatable. But that being said, even somebody who actually is horrible, if they were railroaded, like it's still not okay, right? Mm-hmm. But honestly, Titus reminds me a lot of, I mean, I live in a really small town in New Hampshire. I didn't grow up in New Hampshire. I moved here as an adult and I'm still kind of getting used to sort of like the personalities that inhabit rural communities. And to me, he's very much in line with that kind of person. You know, a guy I know who just did a bunch of work at our house, who I've known for years and years and years, who's wonderful, comes across as the meanest person in the entire world. But you just got to get to know him. It's a very small town thing. I'm really curious about your collaboration, Susan and Jacinda, practically how it works. So you guys have been on the road together. You've interviewed people together. And how does that work? Like, what do you decide to share, not share? Do you both have access to everything you produce? And what is that like?
So for the most part, yes. We have access to everything, like the audio and the recordings. I mean, we probably should have had more ground rules or something. I don't know, but worked out fine. as an attorney, I'd probably be like, you know, maybe you should like plan things out here. But nah, it's fine. We just winged it and it worked out great. the stuff that I do not have is actually the cold case team's recordings from Red Marble. There are two cold case detectives and a prosecutor they were able to interview, and they cannot share that audio with me without their permission. So I don't have that. But other than that, yeah, we're just basically sharing everything.
Hmm. How's the collaboration going for you, Jacinda? What's it like working with Susan?
It's a lot of fun working with Susan. It was, you know, being on the road with Susan is very different than what I'm used to in terms of sitting down and shooting an interview, right? Where it takes you a couple hours to set up and you have the lights and the camera and the person comes in and, you know, you've got to talk to them about, you know, answering the questions. And, you know, with Susan and the podcast, it's like, let's get in the car and just drive around and knock on people's doors. And there's something very liberating about that.
Yeah.
And kind of terrifying too. And, so it was a real eye-opener for me, and it was a lot of fun, and I'm kind of hooked now, I think.
Yeah. We had some real marathon stretches, and I was glad Jacinda was up for it, because I was like, we need to go out there again, and she was always like, yeah, let's go out there right now. So it's been like, Jesus, I put probably 2,000 plus miles in my car last month, if that.
I was thinking about that a lot, listening to your tape, you know, making a TV show, it takes a tremendous amount of time. I mean, I don't think people realize that when they watch even a POV interview, like there's hours of setup. I mean, sometimes you're sitting there, even if you're the subject of it, for a really long time while people are moving stuff around you and getting the lights right and then like blotting your forehead and doing all that stuff. And, you know, in any kind of audio story, you are showing up with your microphone and you are just sort of seeing what happens and seeing how it plays out. And I'm curious about, you know, those two production styles. Like, Jacinda, did you find yourself at times like, wait, I don't have what I need right now? Or did you find yourself like, I didn't think I had what I needed, but maybe we can make this work? Like, where did you land on that?
Well, the stuff that, you know, with me going out with Susan, that's primarily for the podcast, not so much for the show.
Right.
But I did find myself, you know, the first few interviews we did thinking, oh, wait, we have to rephrase the answer. You know, you have to work the question into the answer. The audience won't know what you're talking about. You know, not used to having my voice heard.
Hmm. So Jacinda, you're right. When you're being interviewed by a TV producer, you know, sometimes they ask you to sort of restate the question in their answer. But yeah, in audio, you can be right in there. I mean, I actually love hearing the little interactions of the two of you together, and I hope there's more of that in the podcast. Will there be?
There's a lot of that. There'll be more for sure.
And I'm always... That's another audio storytelling trick, is the producer debrief, to talk to each other when you can't get something on tape.
Yeah. That is often necessary. And for me, like, even after all these years of this, like, when I'm out in the field, I guess my focus is always on getting information.
Right.
And I do try my best to remember I'm doing a podcast as well and get audio I need for that. But I often am, I mean, like, sometimes you got to choose. Like, do you want to make sure, like, you get the info or get a get an interview, or do you want to make sure you can get a nice, delicate, like, sound situation?
Right.
And usually I fall on the side of, like, let's just get in there, learn what we can, get out.
Everybody who listens to Undisclosed knows that it's not going to be public radio. Sometimes it will just be you saying what someone told you. But that's good. I mean, I think that for your podcast, people want the information more so than anything else. That's kind of what it's all about. You guys are making this production, or we're making this production, you know, really during some of the peak months of the pandemic, I'm assuming. How did that work? I know that there's some tape where you're both wearing masks. So we've been warned about that as listeners. But you're also trying to interact with people, I'm guessing some of them sort of spontaneously, who may have been holed up in their homes, like not answering the door or being reticent to answer the door. How did that go for you guys? Jacinda, what do you think?
As if they're reticent.
Most people were very willing to talk to us.
Too willing.
Most people would say, oh, you guys don't have to wear masks. And we'd say, oh, yeah, no, we have to.
I like Jacinda's line, like, oh, if I don't wear it, my boss will get me fired. I started borrowing that. I started using that, too. I am the boss here, but, like, you don't know that, so.
Right. No, yeah, Kevin, I blamed you a lot, so.
It works out well, because when you don't take a mask off, someone's going to be, like, kind of questioning it. But when you say my boss makes me, they're like, oh, it's okay.
Yeah, well, it's a recurring theme for her to blame a lot of stuff on me, so.
But people were willing to talk. I mean, people would be like, why don't you come inside? And, you'd have to say, no, let's stay outside.
Yeah, it's nice to stay out here. Let's stay out on the porch.
Yeah.
It is nerve-wracking. And it is, I mean, we've tried to be as safe as we can. But, like, it's definitely a lot of tension. And I've definitely had anxiety over it. And then you have, like, little old ladies who are like, where would you feel the safest talking to me? Like, I want to make sure you're comfortable. Like, it's not about me, lady. Like, it's not my comfort and safety that the concern here. It's like yours. And they seem totally oblivious to that my actual concern is not me at all.
Yes. You're like, I'm the one who's been going house to house for the last several weeks.
And Jacinda, people kept telling us, like, at the door, like, oh, I don't have COVID. You can take that off. Like, you don't know where we just met a second ago. You don't know where we came from. Like, I'm glad you don't have COVID, but you got no idea we got.
Now, Susan, you mentioned earlier, you brought up the Dennis Perry case, and I know that you think that listeners might see similarities between this season and the Dennis Perry case. What do you mean by that?
There are definitely some overlaps, just in terms of timelines, in terms of the original investigators versus the cold case team. I mean, yeah, when I first started looking at this case, I'm like, oh, so Roy Ballad is our Joe Gregory, and Bruce Worsema is our Butch Kennedy. And the lead cold case investigator from the Perry case is kind of Mike Workman in this case. So the personalities definitely sort of fall into a pattern. And yeah, I was like, at first I was kind of like, do you really want to tell the same thing of like a late 80s, 1990 murder that was solved 10 years later by this new cold case grant and some overeager and very confident cold case detective who, you know, suddenly found the answer that eluded the previous guys all over again. So that pattern is definitely recurring here. But in terms of the sort of issues involved and the evidence, I was surprised at like how different they started to feel as the work went on.
So this was this a cold case unit that was funded by like a piece of legislation over a period of years? Like they had a limited number of years to, you know, prove their mettle or something like that?
Yeah. See, that's one thing I'm still curious about. Like there's definitely some overlaps with how like the cold case team in the Dennis Perry case is like, oh, it's a federal grant that we can't identify and can't explain that's funding this. And there's sort of a similar vibe here. I'm still not sure where the money is coming from, but keeping that money going was absolutely a factor.
I have an excellent guess for you, Susan, because the same thing happened here in New Hampshire, and it was a federal grant that was Homeland Security money post 9/11. So we had a cold case unit form. They had 3 years to solve 100 plus cases.
Wow.
through a grant program. And, you know, there is a lot of pressure because, of course, once a state gets that, they want to keep it. So they have a lot of pressure to, like, you know, get on the stick and, like, solve some murders.
Wait,
They literally had to solve 100 cases?
Yeah, they were given, oh, trust me, we've thought about pitching this as a TV show many times. But yes, the New Hampshire Cold Case Unit had 3 years, I believe, to solve 120-something cases. This was that was the amount of cases that were cold. There were a lot of cases sort of on that pile that have been resolved. By the way, the Bear Brook case, Susan, was one on the pile of cases that they were given to solve. It's probably the highest profile one that has.
Man, can you imagine if they solved Bear Brook, but like only 98 of their cases? So they're like, sorry, you didn't get your 100.
Well, it was interesting, and this is a little off topic, but they sort of organized them by solvability, right? Yeah. So there was like a sort of cold arson case where there was like, so, you know, so they were able to solve some just by finishing the work. So they did some really strong prioritization, but then some of them just had, you know, literally the resources hadn't been there at the time, or the technology hadn't been there. It's a very interesting sort of model, but I do understand why, you know, if they have a big one like this one that they had in Michigan, why they would then use that and leverage it and then feel attached to it. Like I kind of get it, even though I think it's wrong. I kind of at least understand. It doesn't seem like it has those sinister motivations that we hear about in some of the other cases that you've done.
Yeah. Well, these guys are very proud of their 100% record here. So.
I'm curious, you know, we talked a little bit before about Jeff Titus's personality. How much did his character and who he is work its way into the state's case against him?
It was the state's case against him.
Really?
Essentially.
I know you're going to like get to that later, but tell me just a little bit about that.
Like most of the witnesses are not, like there is nothing direct to tie him to the scene. There's like, I mean, they have a few witnesses that were like a couple neighbors and stuff that, you know, sort of have evidence, but like I think probably what, at least 80%, maybe more. It's just like old coworkers of Titus. Maybe not that much, but like a good chunk, oh, like probably half. Pushing more is just like coworkers from him over the past 10 years or even before the murders too, and stuff they have to say about, you know, how weird he was as a coworker.
I was really curious about the detective's assertion that because he mounted his hunting trophies that made him a psychopath or something.
Yeah.
I'm like, so does everybody who mount their deer heads, you think that they're all capable of murder? That just seemed a little bit of a stretch to me.
To be fair, Titus's interest is a bit more intense. And he probably has quite a few more than the average deer head collector.
Happiness is a pile of guts, is what he said.
Although I looked it up, there's like Etsy shops that have like that embroidered into like
pillows. Really?
Yeah.
Huh. Interesting.
So it's not just Jeff Titus, and definitely hunters get him a lot more than non-hunters.
Right.
But he's pretty single-minded about it. And he has to know not everyone likes hunting, but he does not seem to have like actually comprehended this fact.
Yeah. Well, we do hear Warsima in your tape talk about his interpersonal relationships and talk about like the man he would be meeting today if he, you know, were to meet Jeff Titus today. But he has some like kindly things to say about him. I want to say like reticent kindly things to say about him. He talks a little bit about Jeff's marriage, talks a little bit about him being hardworking. Jacinda, do you think that strikes closer to the truth? And do you agree with Susan that it was just like his personality that ended up getting him convicted?
I think it was his personality, you know, and I think, I forget who it says it in the show, is it Mike Brown or Mike Workma? You know, says it was Jeff's big mouth that got him convicted. And in many ways, that's true. It's absolutely true. I think his personality was on trial. You know, like Susan said, there's just not a lot of evidence that links him to the crime or even places him there. And instead, it was Jeff and his character that was on trial. And even the original detectives, like you were saying, have, you know, Bruce Warsima tells a story about, you know, meeting Titus and going to his barn and seeing the carcasses hanging and just feeling really creeped out by it, you know, not particularly feeling safe or comfortable. But Bruce is not a hunter. Roy Ballett is a hunter and he, you know, likes Jeff and they got along quite well. And so it is kind of like your point of reference, I think, when you deal with Jeff on how you're going to like him or not.
Jacinda, we heard about the alibi in the podcast, and it was described by Wasima as a rock solid alibi. What is he called? A golden alibi? Is that what the expression he used was? I'm just curious, is that universally believed to be the case? Like, do you guys see it as a golden rock solid alibi?
No, that's an interesting question. He has an alibi. He was with Stan hunting all day long, but there is a window where no one had eyes on him. There's about a 2-hour window where Stan didn't see him. So it does create a hole in the alibi. And I guess
it's really just two alibis, right, Jacinda? It's really like the original detectives get part of the alibi, but not the second part. And that's really where everything comes unhinged 10 years later, right?
Exactly, yeah.
Hmm. Well, if anything, the cold case team actually strengthened the alibi by finding more witnesses. Like, they added two of the pile of witnesses that were interviewed who could back up the alibi. They didn't take away from it.
Hmm. Can you talk a little bit more about that, Susan? What do you mean?
So it's a couple more. One of the issues is that Stan Driscoll was not interviewed by the cold case team or by the original investigators. The original investigators talked to the Shepherds, talked to Jeff, but there was someone else with them that day, namely Stan Driscoll, who it was not until the cold case team talked to him. They got him on the record as well.
Huh.
Right. So they used Stan. So Stan is another alibi witness that the original detectives didn't have. But Stan admitting that he didn't see Jeff for 2 hours is what the cold case team uses to sort of tear apart the alibi.
Right. So their theory is that he, under the auspices of hunting with his friends, you know, snuck away from whatever blind or whatever he was sitting in for the purposes of murdering these two people and then came back. Like, that's the theory of the crime.
Yes, but he couldn't have intended it. He had to sneak away without knowing he was sneaking away because he couldn't have known that there were any hunters there to kill. So
I see.
Basically, he had this like itching feeling that someone somewhere might be near his property. So he had to go carefully drive all the way back home.
Sense.
Yeah.
This is a man who we know lives and breathes for hunting. Like, that's his favorite thing to do, and that's what he wants to spend every minute doing. So for him to just decide to pick up and leave his hunting blind when there's only a couple hours left to hunt, what would have been that motivation? What would have provoked him to all of a sudden decide to go check on his property 27 miles away?
Right. I do have a question about the victims. Susan, you mentioned on the podcast that Doug and Jim were not part of the same hunting parties, right?
They were not.
Did they know each other otherwise?
Well,
or were they strangers?
We'll get into that more in episode 2.
Okay.
It's a complicated question. But I think for the typical story, the way it's told, and like, they're definitely not, they're not close friends. They're definitely not like closely connected. And it does not seem like they were there together on purpose.
Really? All right. Well, I guess I'll have to wait until I'm producing next week's episode before I learn more about that. So what is Jeff Titus's current legal status? Susan, who is defending him? Like, where are we in terms of his case? Is this another one of those ones where there's hope, or is this another one of those ones where there's very little hope? What do you think?
I mean, there's always hope. this one, Jeff is, his current attorneys are with the Michigan Innocence Clinic. So similar to our last case with Fred Freeman. And he has had appeals and habeas that have been denied, but I know that his attorneys are hard at work and that there is significant new evidence to consider. So I do think that there's reason to feel like this is not one of our longest lost causes, but nothing's ever easy or given or close in these cases. So yeah, right. I feel optimism, but like the kind of tentative, like, don't get hopes up too much kind.
Right, right. And doesn't the pandemic just add so much more pressure but difficulty to these? Because everyone's office is closed.
No one's
working on things. At the same time, it's more urgent than ever to get somebody out who shouldn't be there, right?
It's extremely up. Yeah. That, and there's definitely a lot of stuff in his case that should ground to a halt because of the pandemic. It's he was at Lakeland, which I think is probably, if not though, it's one of the worst in America, if not the worst, in terms of COVID deaths. And so Titus officially never had symptoms, but he was very, very desperately sick, like in February, which is kind of too early to have been COVID, I guess. But I sort of wonder about that one. Either way, he survived it. Although he was mentioning, Jacinda, about the people, a couple people in his unit who were reinfected.
Yeah, he said a couple people tested positive twice. I'm not sure about that. He also said that he tested positive at one point, but at that point, he wasn't showing any symptoms. Like you said, he was really, really sick in February. He had to have breathing treatments and go to the infirmary. But yeah, it sounds like it swept through his ward.
Well, Jacinda and Kevin, I'm curious, you know, the Killer in Question episode on the Jeff Titus case is on November 1st. And what will I, as a viewer, see in that episode that I'm not getting from the podcast? No offense, Susan, but tell me why I should tune in and why everyone listening to this podcast should tune in. And then can you also tell me what's coming up on the show after the Titus case?
Yeah. Well, I think it's largely different in that I believe Jacinda and I both have very definitive opinions as to Jeff's sort of guilt or innocence. And if you ask me next week after the show airs, I will tell you what mine is.
Okay.
But the goal of the show is really to let the audience decide for themselves. I know that Undisclosed has, you know, they believe he's innocent. I think the show for us is we didn't go into it with the perspective of, you know, he's innocent and we want to prove that. We went into it with the perspective of we wanted to present two sides of the argument. And during that process, Jacinda and I came to our determinations, but we didn't put those determinations in the show. We want the audience to look at both sides and to determine that. And so I think that right there is the essential difference. Is that we want to let the audience kind of be the jury in this one. And we did our best to present the evidence of each side to the other side. We tried to show the cold case cops what we had, and we tried to show the original detectives what we had. And Susan aided us a lot in that at the end, being able to have a lot of that stuff that she's uncovered.
That's so interesting.
Yeah, and she helps us sort of present some stuff at the very end, which I think the audience will find very interesting at the very least. And so for us, you know, the show was about, in its conception, was about presenting both sides. And so we've tried to stick to that model with doing that. And hopefully the audience will come to their own determinations. And that's the goal of the entire series. We're not going to take a particular side. And now Jacinda and I certainly have them, but.
And you promise you'll tell me next time we talk?
I will tell you next time we talk. And I will tell you why I think those things. And I think the show turned out great. I wish that, you know, we could have even done more on it. I mean, 2 hours, we were talking about it before, about cutting something down. It was really hard to get this show to 2 hours. It was really difficult. And there are things that I watch where I watch the show now and my brain still remembers something else there and I miss it. But it's, you know, that's the nature of television. And, but, you know, the goal of the show is to present the audience with both sides and let them make their determination. And hopefully they chat about it. And then hopefully they come to Undisclosed looking for more answers. So,
Jacinda, what are you hoping audiences will take away from the show?
Well, just to add to what Kevin was saying, and I think both sides, the original detectives and the cold case detectives, are very convincing in their argument. You know, the original detectives, if you spend some time with the original detectives, you're going to come out thinking Jeff is innocent. If you spend time with the cold case detectives, you're going to be convinced he's guilty. And I think that's really interesting journey to go through as you watch the show, to have your own point of view go back and forth as you're hearing each of these guys talk about the case and why they think he's either guilty or innocent.
The other thing I find really interesting about this story, and I think Susan and Jacinda certainly experienced it much more than I did, sort of being on the ground in Kalamazoo more, but was that I don't think that a lot of this evidence, certainly both sides, has ever been presented in one place. Right? Like, I was astounded as we went through the production of this, how many people just hadn't heard another side of the story, or how many people were actually missing facts. I mean, there are a few times where Jacinda and I just sort of paused, like, I can't believe that they don't know that. Yeah. Like, how could Jeff's attorneys, or how could these police officers not know about this? And so I do think that the show and the podcast will be the first time where even people involved with the story will hear things.
Especially
that really
the people involved in the story.
Yeah, right. That they really should already know.
Yeah.
And I think that that's one of the amazing things to me. And I almost wonder, you know, I have a feeling that as the show's going, or certainly right after, that Jacinda's phone is probably going to blow up with some of these people. Like, I didn't know that. Mm. I was just astounded at the lack of awareness even the people involved had about other sides of the story. And I can't wait to see what the reaction to that is, because there's a lot of information that just people don't have. And that perplexes me. And, it, you know, I think that that's one of the great takeaways from this, is that somebody always has more information. The question is, can you find them? Can you get them to talk about it? I think it's happening a lot in this story.
I feel like that happens a lot in cases that we've worked on, where you're kind of surprised at how little witnesses and people closely connected to, like, the victims or the defendant really know. But it's especially so in this case. Like, it is, I mean, Jacinda, how many times we're like, talk to someone that you just assume would have like a basic understanding of the facts, and they just know close to nothing.
I find that so amazing. Yeah, like, just basic facts they don't have. That's amazing to me.
But if you think about the way people are brought into investigations, it's either because they were brought in for a reason, so they're only given the information that they need to fulfill that purpose, or they have a, you know, very strong point of view about whether or not somebody did or didn't do it. So, you know, the confirmation bias just sort of blinds, you know, people to the bigger picture. What you just described to me, though, you know, presenting each side the other's point of view, you've got me hooked. All I can think about is that great 30 for 30 Michael Jordan documentary, where people would show Michael Jordan interviews of other people talking about him on their little iPad. And we get to watch his reaction to, say, Isaiah Thomas smack talking him. It was all really good, and I'm really looking forward to watching it. I'm curious, Jacinda, what other kinds of cases are we going to be seeing on your show?
Oh, we have some really interesting cases up after the Tyson case. What date is it, Kevin? November 8th will be a case looking at James Duckett, who was a cop in Mascot, Florida, who was convicted of killing an 11-year-old girl. It's a really, really small town. He was the cop on duty when she went missing and was the last known person to see her alive. So again, another interesting case where the evidence isn't so straightforward, and the evidence can be interpreted differently, and you can interpret it to prove that he's guilty or innocent. And he's currently sitting on death row in Florida.
Well, you have two sets of police officers in that case as well. Who?
Oh yeah, they do.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah,
yeah. And that's true, I always find that interesting. And another case we have airing after that is the case of Thomas Sisko, who was convicted of committing a triple murder in Lake Charles, Louisiana. I don't have the year in front of me, but sometime in the late 90s, I believe. And he would then proceed to give numerous what can be called questionable or false confessions. So part of it is figuring out, what do you think really happened that night? And is he telling the truth? I mean, he's a very unreliable witness, but he's the only witness they've got.
Dude, this guy gives Jay a run for his money.
Really?
Yeah. Huh.
I mean, you only have his word to go on. And if he gives you 12 stories, how do you know which one's the truth?
Right.
And then you're dealing with some incredible sort of Louisiana politics.
Yes.
Which is sort of legendary. So, I mean, those are the next two stories. And, you know, we can tell you more about the fourth one as we get going on. It's kind of a family drama. But, I think that they all have their own sort of unique identity, which is what we try and do with all of our shows. and we just try and follow the POVs of the people involved. I mean, in each of these stories, we have the people who were involved in the case, who lived it sort of day to day, which is what we do with all of our shows. We're not looking to get, you know, experts to tell us the story. It's from the mouths of the people who participated. I think that they're all very unique and different stories, and the way that they function as a series, just in the sense that there's all debate about the evidence. That's it. There's nothing else that sort of ties them together other than nobody's always really sure what happened. They all have different points of view.
So, Susan, coming up next week in Undisclosed, what can we expect on the episode 2 of this series?
We'll get more into how it is that the victims, Doug Estes and Jim Bennett, ended up there that day. And what led up to them somehow ending up being killed close together.
Complicated question. I can't wait to hear the answer. Well, Jacinda and Kevin, thanks so much for joining us for this week's addendum. I look forward to talking to you guys again soon.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. Look forward to it.
And Susan, thanks for letting me host the addendum this season again. I really enjoy these conversations. And really, I can't wait to hear more of the season of Undisclosed. Thanks so much for pursuing this case.
Thanks, Rebecca.
And if you want to watch Killer in Question, the episode about Jeff Titus airs on Sunday, November 1st at 9 p.m. Eastern, 8 Central. I'll be watching. I hope you watch it too. Thanks so much for listening to this week's addendum. Do you have a question for next week's addendum? You can email questions to undisclosedpodcast@gmail.com or send them in to us on social media on Facebook, Twitter, or Instagram. Just use the hashtag UDAddendum. Undisclosed executive producer is Methil Telhan. Audio production is done by Hannah McCarthy. I'm Rebecca Lavoie. Thanks so much for listening to this week's addendum. More to come next week.